Welcome to the Queer Movie Podcast, celebrating the best
and worst
in LGBTQ plus cinema, one glorious genre at a time.
I'm Rowan Ellis.
Yes, you are, and I'm Jazza John.
Each episode, we discuss a movie from a different genre of cinema. Today's genre is
Queer animation. Yes, this episode, we are going to be talking about the Oscar-nominated, but spoiler, didn't win the Oscar for animation, Nimona, which started off as a graphic novel published in its entirety in 2015, but also existed as an online webcomic written by Andy Stevenson.
Isn't that just how queer media happens nowadays? Everyone loves to do a webcomic and then get it on the televisions.
Yeah, the queer Tumblr comic to TV pipeline is real. Yeah, very strong. But before we get metal and transform into a rhinoceros, Rowan, as tradition dictates, I need to ask you, what is the gayest thing you have done since the last episode? And please take your time while I try and think of what mine is.
Yeah, what was the gayest thing I've done since the last episode? It's one of those ones where I suddenly get paranoid that this is the thing that I said for last time.
Rowan, I've done that several times.
Yeah, you know
what?
At least two or three teams
I've given the same thing.
I did some mentoring in Brighton. There was a residential for the queer youth organisation that I was at the residential for last summer, if anyone remembers that. And it was very fun, but also extremely rainy, simply so much rain, and it involved a lot of walking around outside, truly sopping wet the entire time.
And as we know, water is gay.
Water is gay. Actually, yeah, that's exactly it. It was like 10% it was gay because of all of the gay, and 90% because of the water. Also by the sea, because it was Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
And the sea is gay. And also, I guess
Brighton
is gay.
Which is where, yeah, which is where queer people go to die.
That is factual. Jazza, how about you?
For once, you know, Rowan, I'm not going to say that I went to a drag show or that I did something gay and sporty or that I went on a date. I got a mullet about three years too late to the game.
Sorry, just onto the webcam a little bit more and show me the mullet. Sure, yeah.
It's subtle.
Okay? It's a subtle mullet.
It's a sullet. We'll workshop that.
Okay.
Why am I referring to myself as we? I'm royal now. We now are getting mistaken for Australian quite a lot.
Yeah, that's a very, I feel like mullet's very Australian hair.
Yeah, it's given like light bogan, and I'm enjoying it. I feel like the next step is, as the spring months come in, I need to bleach blonde it and then go a ridiculous colour, Rowan. Don't worry, I won't come for blue. That will always be yours.
I mean, I wouldn't mind, but if we did, it would be maybe a little bit too much, like we were morphing into the same person. And I feel like the world couldn't cope.
Shall we get on and talk about this movie?
Yes, let's.
We will be spending just a second introducing you, dear audience member, to some of the background of queerness in children's animation, and also the history of this IP as a webcomic, and the turbulent development that this film had in the run-up to being reasonably well-received, especially getting that Oscar nomination. We'll then be splitting the film into three whole acts. We will remember the three acts that we've split it into. It is highly likely, listener, that one of them is going to be the party in its aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to be giving the movie a score using our allegedly patented rainbow flag system.
Yes, I definitely have patented it. I've sent the emails and or paperwork and or phone call off that's necessary for doing that. And so please do not try and steal it because it would be pointless.
It would be completely pointless.
Our lawyers would be on you. That's how that works, right?
And they definitely exist. We are going to be spoiling this movie. This is for people who have seen the movie and, I guess, read the webcomic or don't care about the movie or the webcomics being spoiled.
But I would say just go watch it. It's very good and you should watch it. And there are some bits in it which I wouldn't say like plot twists as such, but there's definitely some unexpected stuff in there. So definitely go and watch it. It's only, short, and then come back and listen to this.
Yes, good. Look at us supporting queer cinema. It's almost like that's what we want to do. So without further ado, let's just curate that murder wall and review Nimona.
So I think I'm going to grab the context first, because I think it leads quite well into what you're going to talk about, because I want to talk about specifically queer kids stuff around animation, films, things like that. Mm-hmm. Because it's been a meme for a long time of Disney's first gay character, where so many characters have been Disney's first gay character.
It's happened so many times. Also, like the cliche of it being like a big part of the press tour of a lot of movies. Yes. And then it being a bit of a damp squib.
Yep, led to the term that I coined, queer catching, which has been used in numerous academic texts now, which is fun, which is essentially kind of like a mirror image of queer baiting. Like queer baiting is they put queer context in the actual piece of media, and then when they're doing the press for it, they deny that it's gay. Whereas queer catching is in the press, they go, yeah, totally gay. We did a really heroic and exciting thing here. And then you watch the actual media and go, did you, though? I didn't see it.
I literally blinked and I missed your gay kiss in that flashback that you provided.
One second. That could be cut out very easily for overseas markets. We have, however, had a Disney's first gay character, or at least the first sort of main character who is canonically queer and is themselves a young person, which was in Strange Worlds, which we have also reviewed on the podcast. So if you want to hear us talking about Disney's very first definitely real gay character, you can do that. Mm-hmm. But obviously previously, not just in Disney, but other pieces of media, we had in How to Train Your Dragon, we've had in Paranorman, various other places, these little bits pop up, but it's in general not been like a main character or a huge part. And I think that this is depressingly predictable, but it's one of those things that still frustrating, and I think absolutely has an impact in terms of young queer people not being able to see anyone who looks like them on screen, either someone going through similar struggles to them now, or an adult who has gone through these struggles and come out the other side to be living like a happy, fulfilling mm-hmm. life. And we have had over the years some within young persons media on TV and in movies, but it tends to be specifically edgy teen stuff like Skins, which mm-hmm. is specifically not for kids. It's like, oh yeah, this is a teen show, but it's the whole point of it is that it's cool and edgy and boundary pushing, and that's when they'll let you have the gay characters.
Yeah, definitely didn't watch Skins when I was definitely a minor and underage and knew nothing of drug culture and of homosexuals. Mm-hmm.
You're very straight edge. And we see mm-hmm. it in things like the Doctor Who versus Torchwood kind of separation, where ultimately both of them are set in the same universe and they're both campy and silly and ridiculous, but one of them is a lot more gay and has also got orgasm aliens. Like the sexual element is very much there. And I think looking at the Sarah Jane Chronicles, where the lead Luke, the sort of boy in that, was meant to be queer and they just never got around to essentially making it canon. This was in the plan, in the works, in the writer's room, but it just never ended up being on screen. There is a lot of question marks about how much the BBC had influence over that decision. And so I think it is really linked to this idea that queerness is inherently adult. But we have seen, and I think we joked before about the idea of the pipeline between queer graphic novel to queer TV show, but I do think that kids and YA publishing is way ahead of the times in comparison to movies and TV shows in terms of representation and queer representation specifically. So it doesn't actually surprise me that much that we have a situation where we do have a bunch of stuff that is getting made specifically because it is an adaptation of something which already has an audience behind it that feels like less of a risk, as it were. And I do think that Nimona, for me, is such an amazing piece of queer cinema because it really has queerness at the heart of it, both in terms of the characters and in terms of themes. And it's also a celebrated movie. It is artistically stunning, interesting, and boundary pushing in a variety of ways. So I love it, but also I'm slightly shocked that it managed to exist at all. But I think Jazza, not segue, you, I think, were looking at that particularly.
I do have a little bit. However, can we go back to, because this is, the publishing space is a lot more your world than mm-hmm. mine. And a piece of media that had a similar life cycle to Nimona in terms of first existing as a webcomic, then getting published and then getting picked up for is Heartstopper, obviously, which we have talked about at great length on this podcast. And you're right that it seems like, especially in YA, there is a lot more explicit queer themes across loads of different IPs.
Yeah.
What do you think is the reason for publishing, especially being the outlier there? Is it because, like you said, of publishers trying to find safer bets that already have audiences. So a lot of them started as webcomics, for example. Is there something else? Is there something culturally happening there that is maybe less risk averse than, say, the Disney's picking up a queer story?
Yeah, I mean, it's less money, right? First of all, it's a lot less money to pay an author in advance of a few thousand pounds than it is to make an entire movie or a TV show. So it is, that lack of risk is there. They also, in general, especially the big publishing houses, are going to have way more books published every year than networks or film studios in general. And then there's also the fact that the YA space in the teen space has always been really boundary pushing in a lot of ways. It's arguably gotten less recently within the mainstream, but over the years there has been so many calls to have certain teen books restricted. But I think it's reflected in, I was at a panel that Patrick Ness was on, and he was talking about the fact that he, within his career as an author, gets asked to do a lot of creative writing judging for like competitions of young people. And he always laughs when he gets the entries because so many people comment on his books and books like them in terms of them being too much for young persons, too queer, too adult in a way, not because they're dealing with actually adult themes, but because they're dealing with themes like queerness that are seen as taboo for young people to even know about. And he's like, you should see what these young people are writing about. They are writing some fucked up shit. They really are not, like, they can handle it. They're writing it themselves. They want to be discussing this, talking about this stuff. And I also think there's a lot of elements within, for example, the publishing industry is extremely white, extremely middle class. And I think that there is an element of this kind of the worthiness of marginalized stories in a way that can feel a little bit tokenistic or feel a little bit cringy, but it does get the foot in the door. And I think that it then gets proven, like the sheer number of people who have latched onto Heartstopper, for example, is something that they needed, means that it's something that they also see making money. And so, yeah, that's currently the sort of landscape as it is with queer books. And I'm just hoping that we see more of them be adapted and also those writers bought onto original projects for screen as well.
That is so, so interesting. And I've never really thought about it as kind of like, because the risk is lower, like it just allows them to be able to roll the dice a little bit on something like that. Whereas we know that when you're investing like so much into a movie, for example, like the cliche of the big distributors like Disney, for example, who I'll talk about in a second, they don't want to take on a queer IP that then they would have to drastically change in order for it to be allowed in, say, the Middle East, where certain depictions, or Russia or China, or like all of these markets where queer depictions are a bit of a no in mainstream media.
Yeah, or even the backlash in America, right? Like in certain parts of America.
Yeah, Florida's the big one, right?
If you think about the marketing campaigns, and especially with social media and the way it works now, there's a lot more of a risk in terms of those kind of homophobic people are more likely to hear about a movie than they are about a book, to be honest. And so it feels like a lot of queer books can fly under the radar, and the book banning element is where it starts getting that sort of backlash. But often it's in very specific communities, which is a problem in and of itself, but they don't tend to have these huge marketing campaigns across an entire country where there's trailers and billboards and interviews in the press. And so it's also just more visible to be attacked as well.
Yeah, 100%. So this intellectual property started actually as a thesis project, as a college thesis project by N.D. Stevenson in the early 2010s, around 2012 was, I think, when the first version of this appeared on Tumblr. And after years of serially publishing updates to the story, it then got picked up and was published as a full graphic novel in 2015, where the rights were sold to Fox, and the actual movie was being made by an animation studio called Blue Sky, who were working on it. It was originally going to launch in early 2020, but we know what happened then. And then it was pushed back, and was months from its actual launch date, since Disney had picked up the studio, before Disney shuttered that studio and stopped all of the work that was happening on Nimona. There are rumors I have not found any hard facts about this, which is unsurprising, but there are rumours that one of the reasons that Disney wanted to shutter this, or were so ready to shutter this, despite the fact that it was so close to release, is because of the fact that it had an explicitly queer character, well, two explicitly queer characters, the main character and like a semi-antagonist of it, were gonna reportedly at the time have a gay kiss, which I think, now that we've seen the movie especially, I think that ironically the two gay characters are the least gay thing about this movie. Like, the queerness is in Nimona as the character specifically, who arguably is the part of this story that changes the least and is the thickest, most common thread that goes from the webcomic to the movie that we have now, is like the character of Nimona, mm-hmm. and the foundations of Nimona. And it is so fascinating knowing that history of the webcomic, especially because Andy Stevenson has come out as various things, as like non-binary, bi-gender, now says that he uses mainly he, him pronouns, and generally gets identified as more mask these days. And he started writing this way before he was publicly talking about his own gender identity. But Nimona as a character is so trans and has huge MB gender non-conforming energy. There's the cliche of the shapeshifter, which is like a trope that many trans and NB folks will often identify with. There's old interviews that Andy did that talks about like the shapeshifting element of Nimona as a character, and how Nimona was like a way of Andy being able to express the feeling that he had when doing like cosplay, and the freedom of doing cosplay, which is also like another space that a lot of people use to be able to experiment with gender. It really is like a representation, a little time capsule, a little trans egg, I feel like, in the Andy Stevenson story. And then eventually, after it getting shuttered by Disney, it was picked up for distribution by some of the team that were already working on the Blue Sky version of this, and is now available on Netflix and got an Oscar nomination, which is pretty fucking cool. It didn't win. Studio Ghibli won again, and like, I'm very happy for Studio Ghibli, but I am a bit bored of them being such a successful the Oscars bloody love a Studio Ghibli movie.
The best animated movie nominations this year were stacked.
Yeah, like, amazing.
They were all amazing.
Spider-Man should have won. I'm just gonna put that out there. Spider-Man should have won, but Nimona was like really up there for me. But yeah, that's kind of like the background of this story, of this property, of these characters. Shall we dive into
the movie itself?
The actual movie. Yeah, sure. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Nimona opens with a Shrek 1. Here is the story and the background lore of this story. There was this wonderful kingdom. Everybody lived in peace until the Fire Nation attacked. Oh no, sorry, that's the wrong
movie.
Media. It was actually this monster came to this kingdom, attacked with no warning, which on its own is pretty sus. And then a great savior for this civilization, Glorith, who ends up being referred to as essentially God, is the founder of this civilization that we're now part of. Glorious rocks up. She looks pretty cunt with a sword, I'm not going to lie. Slays the monster.
Pretty cunt with a sword is actually on, if you zoom in, it's an Easter egg at the on her statue at the bottom. That's what it says.
Exactly, cunt. Facts. And then Glorith trained a load of knights, but it's hereditary knights keep on, the bloodline gets passed down, blah, 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 blah. And this is what I've named Act 1 after. Act 1, for me, is called, so it's just an authoritarian hereditary dictatorship. What could possibly go wrong with this society?
Oh, interestingly, I named Act 1 the party in its aftermath.
Oh, interesting. My party in its aftermath comes later. What's your justification?
Multiple parties, baby. But yeah, like, I think one of the strengths of this movie for me is how it slams you straight into the world building. Not just the like, oh, here's the little backstory mythology, but specifically the world building of this setting, which is wild. So cool, so unique, because it is essentially a sort of futuristic medieval hybrid world.
Yeah, like there's flying cars, but also horses.
Science fiction. It's great because they're essentially broadcasting on television a knighting ceremony, Sure, those things very much go together.
Yeah.
And we're introduced to the concept of this is a very special knighting ceremony because it's the kingdom will change forever. There is this street kid who had an impossible dream to be a knight. And this is the day that he gets knighted and the whole of the world will change. Amazing. Woohoo. We love to see it. The queen decided to give him a chance. And we also find out that this is our sort of main character, Ballister. He is top of the class. He is a bit of a teacher's pet, but he kind of has had to be because he is a commoner and that is just unheard of to have become a knight. And it is also shown through this TV report with these little vox pops that the general population is very split on this decision. A lot of them think that it's just not possible, that we can't trust the commoners, that someone like this doesn't have the strength it takes to actually defend the city from the potential return of the big old monster that lurks outside the big city walls.
Mm-hmm. I hear you on world building. I think mm-hmm. the world building in this movie is one of the weaker bits of it.
Ooh.
I love the aesthetic of it. I love the whenever a universe is built that blends like fantasy and sci-fi together, I really like. But the sci-fi elements of it felt unused to a certain extent, and also they've just built a big wall and outside there's no monsters or anything, and it actually turns out, spoiler alert at the very end, that it's all completely fine. Why didn't anybody just look over the wall? They've got flying cars. And that kind of at the end, that bugged me. But I like the concept of this. I just feel like it could have been that idea of like what's outside of the walls and the fact that this is a gated society that only really gets addressed further down the line. I would have liked that to have been shown a little bit better and maybe fleshed out a little bit more in this world building.
Interesting. I like the idea that people are so utterly convinced by this that they don't even think to go out. Like, it's to even try and peek outside would be too dangerous. Like, we've been told what to believe and that's how we're going to believe it, and we all are on the ground in our grimy little city just being like, wow, we love Golden Loin, they're amazing. Speaking of
Eugene from the Try
Ballister,
Guys,
so gay. I know, Eugene from the Try Guys, genuinely brilliant in this role. I really want to see him in more stuff.
Had
like, acting wise
no idea. I would have never been able to realize that it was Eugene. I was expecting for it to just be Eugene's voice, but it's like actual acting.
And I should have been,
can you imagine? Whereas I will say Riz Ahmed does just sound like Riz Ahmed. There's like an East London accent. It just plonks in the middle of this movie, and I do love it for that. But the two of them are their two knights in this. It's
they're
a thousand years
gay.
Since Glorith saved the realm, and they're about to go and do this knighting ceremony, and Ballister is being really broody, specifically broody, and Ambrosius Goldenloin, lol, Goldenloin as a name, brilliant, is like consoling Ballister and says, they're gonna love you like I do. And we get hand touching, hands are gay. And it's explicitly, there's a couple of gays in this movie from the very offset. We're not waiting for like
really
90 minutes
big,
for a
cute
kiss.
Eyes when they look at each other and they snuggle.
Snuggle.
Also, I can't be bothered to look it up now, but people who are listening right now, Jazza did just say that he was broody. I think he was brooding, because I think broody is specifically when you want kids.
Oh, yeah,
but
you're
honestly,
right.
Maybe that as well. Maybe they should adopt. they are so cute and adorable. And I really like it because it's introduced within this sort of TV broadcast world building as if Ambrosius is going to be the kind of foil counterpoint and he's going to be the absolute asshole. We do have one of those. We have the intro to the frat boy that happens now, where he says, it's this absolute Chad of a Kyle who essentially comes in to Ballister and is, hey man, I know I've been tough on you and I never thought you belonged here. And then simply stops talking. And Ballister's like, and he's like, no, that's it. That's the whole thing. I still hate you. And I enjoyed him. There's like a few different villains in this and I enjoyed this very slapstick but still dangerous frat boy, the straight villain of the piece. And because at this point, we also get another potential villain, the director, who says to Ballister, today people will see you for who you really are. As we all know in movies, ambiguity, very suspicious.
Ooh, yeah.
Very suspicious. So I think we're all like, going to keep an eye on you. And this is where we get, this is the party for me. You know, everyone's excited. We're all cheering. There's a lot of little kids in the audience who, as Ballister's called up to get knighted, are like cheering. You can see that the dream of the common people lives with him. And then he just shoots a laser out of his sword and kills the queen. Classic villain Ballister.
Classic. Can I just say, I don't under... Because Ballister is nervous about this, and it feels like there are meant to be stakes at this ceremony. Like, it's not a trial that he has to pass at anything.
Mm-hmm.
It does just seem like the ceremony where everybody just becomes a knight. And so I don't really understand why he's so nervous. There is a moment where we wait for the cheer when he is finally knighted, and the cheer comes. Mm-hmm. But I was expecting a trial or a duel.
No, I think he's already passed. He's a teacher's pet and everything. I think for Ballister, the whole waiting for the crowd to cheer thing is the issue.
Got it.
It's he might be knighted, but will he be accepted? Mm-hmm. Is this something where he, because it also, if this has never happened that someone, there is a possibility of someone not getting knighted, right? It's implied that you go through knight training because you are a son of a son of a son of a mm-hmm. son of the people who fought in the original battle. And so it's like, at any moment, this could be taken away from me. And it might be because the queen suddenly realizes that she's made a huge mistake, or it could be because the whole crowd turns against me. Like, he has to be prepared for the idea that this could go either way.
And it goes the
little baby.
It goes the bad way because a laser pops out of his sword and kills the queen. Ambrosius, who by the way is a direct descendant of Glorith,
mm-hmm.
you can tell from the gorgeous hair, then full on cuts off Ballister's arm in an attempt to disarm him. Literally disarm him. It works. And
he is disarmed.
And then he runs away to a completely non-suspicious secret lair where the doorbell ring? Somebody knocks on the door and he gets introduced to Nimona, who is applying for a job to be Ballister's assistant. Sidekick,
mm-hmm.
who is assuming that Ballister is a legitimate bad guy, really wants to go around and take down society and stuff like that. And Ballister's like, no, I was framed. But Nimona, this spunky, cool, haircutted young girl, is not having...
Young or maybe not young.
Young or maybe not young. Maybe 1,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And
allegedly
has a full-on application to be the sidekick of Ballister. And I guess forces her way into his life. In a really charming mm-hmm. way.
And I think it's, at this point, we have this really dramatic moment where Ballister is like, his arm gets cut off. He is truly the worst possible thing. Like, he was thinking, maybe people won't like me. He wasn't thinking, I'll accidentally murder the sovereign.
Sure, ever but expect we then go to Nimona's... murder a sovereign, let's be fair.
Mm-hmm. Most of us do. But we then cut immediately to Nimona's narration before the title card smash, where Nimona's introducing us to the idea of, hey, what you've seen so far feels like the stories and mythology and the good and the bad and good and evil and all of this kind of stuff. And we're introduced to the idea that this might be a little bit different, that we're going to see like what the real kingdom is like. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also really fun to have a story from the point of view of the sidekick that we never really see. It's always either from the villain or the hero's point of view, and having the point of view of this sort of sidekick character and delving into them is really interesting. Also, I really love the fact that part of Nimona's extremely chaotic and violent excitement is talking about, you know, are we going to get revenge?
Yeah, like, she's curated
plan?
A murder
she
wall.
She says, are we going to rise like a fiery phoenix from the ashes to overthrow the government? And I'm like, huh, a fiery phoenix rising from the ashes to overthrow the government. Wonder if that'll come back around. But yeah, she's essentially all about revenge. He has a wall of information to prove his innocence and she thinks it's a murder wall. All of this stuff is her essentially... We find out later why this is someone that she's attached herself to and why being a sidekick is her vibe. But before she can persuade him officially to let her be his sidekick, he simply gets arrested. He is very bad at being a villain, it turns out. And at that point, the director visits him, who we know has... The general narrative is that she has taken a chance on him, that he really respects her, wants her to really like him, is a bit of a teacher's pet, and she lays it on thick
mm-hmm.
in this meeting. So dramatic, so evil,
I love
we
it
find
so
out
much.
Later.
This is my act two already, so quick.
Oh, I don't get into
so
act two
for
ages.
Me,
okay.
The party in the party and its aftermath is them breaking out mm-hmm. and then being,
oh.
And then, well, Nimona is clearly just having a really nice time. So I've called that the party in its aftermath. I've
Aww,
also given this
cute.
An alternative title of Be Gay, Do Crime.
Yes, no, that is very fair. That was, I feel like, a no-brainer there. Absolutely. Because, yeah, basically, he goes into prison, gets visited by the director, and then Nimona immediately rescues him. And we start also getting these hints at the thematic thread line through this movie where Nomona says, once everyone sees you as a villain, that's what you are. The idea of like perception in villainy, the idea of the way that someone sees you is out of your control in a lot of ways. Very queer theming happening here. Also, I really love the humor in it as well as the more serious elements. I felt like that was balanced really well, and a lot of different types of humor in a way. So there's the situational humor as well as very like quippy dialogue humor. So situational humor, for example, during the escape, our boy Bal is attempting to tell Nomona like, hey, I am not a villain. I will allow you to help me to escape, but we are not going to hurt anyone. We are going to be very good. We are going to prove my innocence. It's going to be great. And Nomona's just really needling at him. And the point at which they bump into Ambrosius at the escape is simply the worst moment ever, because it is Bal doing an impression of Nomona going, murder him, murder her, murder everyone. And then they lock eyes and Bal's like, ruh-roh. It is just so silly. And I think for 90 minutes, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in this story. They really have stripped it down to just the key moments you would want to see from a hero and a villain who, you know, used to be together, and then there's some kind of betrayal, there's I can't trust you anymore, they're on opposite sides, and are they going to get back together? Like, all of these things that are happening kind of in the background, because Nomona fundamentally is the main character here. These two's little like love story, Nomona kind of interprets as a nemesis arc going on, rather than that. It's so good.
When Ambrosius opens the door, when Bal says, murder everyone, Bal says, Ambrosius! And as quick as anything, Nomona goes, Gesundheit. And I'm just like, that is my level. Thank you so much. That is my level of just saying bless you to anybody saying something that is a slightly ridiculous word. Mm-hmm. And then Nomona classifies it as a nemesis. They do some, there's some running that happens. They run around and then they go into a closet. Gay.
Mm-hmm.
Very gay. And then, oh my God, this metaphor is so strong. Nomona's like, I'm about to do something, but you've got to promise not to freak out, right? So she's coming out of the closet. Oh, it's so strong. And Bal goes, no, it's going to be totally fine. And then Nomona starts shapeshifting, turns into a rhinoceros, and then starts like creating chaos around everything, breaks them all out. Nomona is changing into various different things. So like it changes into a fox, an ostrich, and then finally like a giant whale that smashes through everything, destroys 1,000 years of history. Bit like, appreciate your elders, Nomona. And they manage to escape and get back to Bal's. It is a lair, isn't it, really? Like, he's not actually a bad guy, but he does have a lair.
Yeah, he does have a lair, and that's being prepared for you. And we also get this first sort of confrontation between the two, because up until this point, he knows that she has, and I think this is a really interesting point to me, he knows that she has talked about wanting to literally kill people. She has talked about wanting to cause chaos, to be just do so many bad things. But it's not until this moment where he has seen her, in defense of him, to protect him, turn into other creatures and expose herself as a so-called monster, that he starts to actually fear her and judge her in a really active way. And I think that's really interesting to me, that specifically this kind of brainwashing that he's had growing up and what he's been taught within his sort of night school, I guess, about monsters and how bad they are. It takes until he actually sees her as a monster for him to then click everything in his head to really be judging her. And she immediately...
Yeah, I love this bit. Don't call me that.
He's like, what are you? She's like, well, I'm Nomona. And he's like, well, that's not an answer. And she's like, well, yeah, it is. Like, I'm Nomona. And the reason why she's helping him is because everyone hates him as well. And there's such interesting dynamics here, right? There's intricate... I know you said about how the gayest thing is Nomona, but I do like this intra-community
stuff. Give me a label. I want to give you a label. Yeah, yeah. So Ballister is maybe like explicitly, he's the G in LGBT, but maybe Nomona is a Q or somewhere in the plus, right? And you're so right that you see that intergenerational play within the queer community so much. And I love how it plays out here, these two characters trying to understand Nomona specifically and finding the lack of a label so affronting for him. He's, tell me what you are so I know how to move around you. And Nomona is just asking to be treated like a human being, or to be treated as Nomona, as like a friend, as an individual, not to be prerequisited with a certain type of behavior based on like what her identity is, be it a monster or otherwise. And I fucking love that so much.
At this point, we basically, I will like speed run, I think, this next section, because I feel like it's a lot of, we get them being chaotic in pursuit of their plan, and then they get caught and chased, and then they're chaotic in a different setting. But essentially,
some plot
the plan,
happens, it moves forward.
Yeah, some plot, classic act, getting into act two. But the, essentially, their plan is to clear Ballister's name. He realizes the only sort of person who might have any information he can contact is Diego, who is the squire that gave him the sword in preparation for the ceremony. Because the sword is very clearly been tampered with. And so he's like, okay, this is who I've got to go to. So they go on the subway and wreak absolute havoc. They go to the market and wreak absolute havoc. And then in between have these little heart-to-hearts where, for example, on the tube or the subway, depending on how American you want to be, Jazza.
The metro, please, the metro.
Ballas asks Nimona, like, how did you get like this? Kind of his way of interpreting it, where he's trying to reconcile, or at least this is how I'm interpreting it, someone who is helping him and seems to be doing good for him specifically, but who also is this thing that he's meant to hate. And so it's like, oh, maybe someone made you like this. Maybe I can justify it in my head by being like, oh, this isn't who you really are. This was like a thing that happened to you and maybe you can get better. And Nimona gives him this absolutely bullshit flashback of a story where it's played out in the film narrative as if it's going to be her tragic backstory.
Yeah, I love it. Like, I really like this.
And we go into a beautiful stylized animated flashback of her, you know, going into the backstory of like, I went to a wishing well and stuff. And then she's like, and I wish to one day be in a tube carriage with a fucking idiot asking me stupid questions. And he's like, all right, okay, I get it. Like, I won't ask you again. And like, he wants a reason for her queerness.
Like, Nimona's like a full-on gorilla eating a pizza at this point and says to Nimona, maybe you should be human because it would be easier. Nimona goes, easier for who? And Bal is obsessed with this label. What are you? What should I refer to you as? And she calls him an uptight knight asking me small-minded questions. And it reminds like when I'm navigating non-binariness a little bit, people will often make a bigger deal about kind of like, well, what should I call you? How should I refer to you? And I'm like, don't think about it too much. Like, just this is a thing and let's just move on and let's just connect with one another on like a normal individual basis. I don't want you to steep me in like a label that is useful for me in explaining my identity in every single opportunity. Just let me be. And she talks about how when she doesn't transform, when she isn't like being true to herself, it feels worse when she doesn't do it. And then Bal says, would you die if you didn't do it? And she goes, if I didn't do it, I wouldn't die, but I wouldn't be living. And I'm like, that's the gayest fucking thing I've ever heard.
Truly, the queerness jumping the fuck out. Also, when they're having that conversation you just referenced, I should point out to everyone that they have, in fact, kidnapped the squire at that point. They ended up in the market. They did a lot of hijinks and they took him in a flying car in front of Ambrosius. Really, at every turn, I actually want to give some credit to Ambrosius because simply just keep seeing Ballister in the most incriminating circumstances and is consistently like, but my man, love that for him. And this is where I split into act two, is essentially after, basically, almost immediately after that line, I wouldn't die, but I sure wouldn't be living. At which point the squire, who is still in the trunk of the car, is like, wow, I love this bonding I'm hearing outside of this trunk, but maybe you could let me the fuck out. And essentially this is, because this is the part, act two, where we get the, I think I just called it Le Gasp, the truth. It is revealed because this squire gives them video evidence of the fact that the director herself, we knew that we didn't trust that bitch, has essentially been the one who swapped out the sword, meaning that for some reason she decided to kill the queen. And at this point, Nimona is so passionate about going to the public with proof, is like, this is it, we can get her. And Ballister is like, no, I need to show Ambrosius because, you know, this could really threaten the whole of the Institute. Like, this won't just reflect badly on the director, it will reflect badly on the whole of the Ninth Institute.
Of the point,
and Nimona's like, yeah, no shit. That's kind of like, they are the issue. Arm chopping is not a love language, as she says. You don't want to go to this guy, Ambrosius. It was this guy. And points out, you do realize what you're saying, like you're saying about this institute whose whole purpose is to protect the realm. Protect from who? She says, like, villains like you or monsters like me? And Bal is just not in a place to actually understand it. It's still so connected. And I feel like this is something that I really appreciated, is that they didn't just have Bal and Ambrosius as this couple in the beginning where, like, Bal's love interest was just some commoner who was like, no, I must stay away from him because if I'm on the run, I'm a fugitive. And they had one scene together at the beginning and then they never really connected the entire movie. And then right at the end, they get a little cute, happily ever after scene. I love the fact that there was real intense tension between these two characters, that there was stakes within that relationship where there were like real reasons why he would want to try and talk to Ambrosius and give him the information, because it was like genuinely his connection to the knights is not just as someone who was an aspiring knight, but someone who's the man he loves. That's his entire life as well. And that was something that they connected over. And so, yeah, I just really loved the way in which they included that sort of queer relationship all the way through. And every sort of few scenes we're reminded of it because he's looking at Ambrosius's picture and being really heartbroken, or they're having these confrontations. And I just thought it was 10 out of 10.
So they go back to the institution. They're chaotic for a little bit more, and then they steal away again. But we see a scene where allegedly Ambrosius confronts the director, where the director talks about her motivation for killing the queen. Basically, it's a slippery slope argument of, if we let in one commoner, then no one's going to be able to defend us from the monsters outside in the wall. And then she's like stabs Ambrosius with Ballister's sword. Turns out it was actually Nimona pretending to be Ambrosius. Plot twist. Another reveal. And
That
whole thing, the director has found an old scroll that shows Nimona being the big monster that is the thing that we heard about at the beginning of this whole movie when the Fire Nation attacked. Exactly.
It's all coming around. Full circle.
The real Ambrosius has been shown this by the director. He now thinks that Nimona is the one manipulating Bal. And so he messages Ballister saying, hey, do you want to get nachos? They have nachos. They argue about nachos. The director is going around saying, look, there's evidence. This monster is a shapeshifter. She could be anybody. Planting seeds of distrust among the wider population. To the point where Bal goes back, now that he knows that Nimona was the original monster that attacked 1,000 years ago, Bal goes back and confronts Nimona and begins to, out of fear, pull a sword on her. Like, a load of knights arrive at the hideout and Nimona runs, and we get the flashback of Nimona's origin story. We get to see those opening kind of like fairy tale credits from Nimona's perspective, where we see that she would transform into various different animals and try and find friends, and nobody wants to hang out with her, whether she's like a sparrow or a fish or a deer. It's genuinely very sad. And then the only person who ever hangs out with her when she's in girl form is a young Glorith. And then like Glorith accepts her, etc., etc., etc. But then the adults around Glorith see Nimona as a monster when she transformed, despite Nimona trying to show that she is no threat. And then Glorith, turns out, this is my act three, by the way, my final act. Glorith was the monster all along.
Whoa.
Gasp. Wow, so deep. And so after this flashback of reminiscing and finding out that Glorith turning on Nimona originally was like the origin story of this whole, not just of Nimona, but also this whole kind of like kingdom, Nimona full on goes Godzilla and turns into the black monster and goes all kaiju on the kingdom.
I just want to say as well, like one of the things that happens within the bit before this where we see Bal and Nimona go and essentially confront the director and Ambrosius with the evidence that they had, being like, hey, we found this evidence that you replaced the sword. They don't even get to show the evidence to anyone because immediately the director is essentially tricks the knights into destroying it by being like, he's pulling a weapon, and they pew pew it out of his hands. But we get within that section some really interesting stuff where we start to see Bal really seeming to understand and start to appreciate what Nimona has been saying. He's not necessarily fully convinced, but he's talking about the fact that, you know, sees Nimona upset and is clearly really concerned about her, tries to make sure she's okay, talks about the fact like, okay, new plan, we're getting you out of here. We need to protect you. We're going to get you over the wall. I'll come with you. You know, no matter what we do, we can't change the way people see us. And it's Nimona that says, but you changed how you see me. And that is so interesting as a shift between them, because originally she's the one who's like, they never think anything differently of us. We'll always be villains to them. And so we kind of had to go through these moments of Bal showing this sort of prejudice and then getting over it for Nimona herself to start to learn that that's not just how everyone's always going to see her, and that she can believe in maybe the possibility of the good in people again. And that dynamic and the way it's constantly shifting, even within these 90 minutes, is so interesting to me. Also, what's even sadder is the fact that we now, with that flashback, we now know that she was betrayed by a friend, and that it almost hurts even more for her because it's someone that has said, let's leave together, I trust you, like, we need to protect you. All of these things that she's probably hoped for like 1,000 fucking years that someone would say to her and mean, and she believes it. And then he turns around and calls her a monster. And that is, just breaks my fucking heart. And then it's what she turns into. So I'm, spoiler alert for you, Jazza, I am literally, after we record this, filming a video essay about queer villains.
God, what a little teaser.
And Nimona is heavily in it, because it is such an interesting examination of a villain who is only a villain within context, and that whose queerness is tied to villainy. And I find it like so interesting. And I think what's really interesting about this sort of last big dramatic finale, where Nimona is turned into this great black monster and is entering the city, is that we don't know Nimona's intentions at that point, but it's assumed by the director, by the knight, she is coming to do a Godzilla, to do a kaiju, to basically destroy the city. And when you watch it, and especially if you watch it back, you realize that she's not really doing any damage. All the damage that happens is from the knights trying to attack her in a very similar way to what happened in the village in the flashback, where they tried to burn her and they ended up burning their own village down, that they are the ones who are creating explosions and forcing her off the open path of the road in order to start like crashing into buildings or crashing into cars or trying to hurry. And then like all of this stuff, or at least most of it, is all actually them causing the damage. And we also realize that Nimona's actual plan is not to attack the city and to go and attack the director. It's essentially to commit suicide by impaling herself off the huge statue of Goreth at the center of the city, which is why she's having to move through the city itself. And that is, it's hinted at previously, where Nimona says something along the lines of, I don't know what scares me more, the fact that so many people want to run a sword through my heart, or that sometimes I want to let them. And this is, again, we're like called back to. And so this big confrontation ending finale is not how we might expect in a story like this of like the knights against the monster. The big finale is essentially Bal trying to apologize to Nimona, trying to explain to her that he was wrong.
He says, I'm sorry. He stops her from impaling herself.
And that he sees
her. Says, I'm
sorry.
I see you, Nimona. You are not alone. And that.
Kill me, weeping. Stab me in the heart myself. And we also see the citizens being moved by this. The idea as well that it's not that people inherently are like mean and suspicious and violent, but that the propaganda that has been fed to people that keeps them in that state of moral panic that we've seen like across the entirety in terms of what the director's been saying about the plot we've been following is false. And that if you give people these moments of truth and these moments of connection, of queerness, of empathy, and allow them to view that without the moral panic around it, that they will be moved by it, that they will start to question, that they will start to understand. And we see that within the citizens gathered who start to be like, oh, that this is not what we thought it was.
Yeah, the director.
But obviously the director is not going to be taking that long.
The director is like, let's turn it and obliterate half the city just so that we can kill Nimona. It's at this point in my notes that I wrote, well, I.
Okay, Daenerys Targaryen.
Under this, the director is a TERF. And I'm running with this. The director and the desire for her to destroy wider society for the sake of this scary thing that she doesn't really understand or know anything about. She now, for me, represents TERFdom and the rise of TERFdom.
Yeah. I think specifically you can see on her computer screen that she's writing an article right now for the Shield Guardian, which is a news outlet, which is just entitled, Stop Giving Monsters Hormone Blockers.
Yeah, so I then refer to her in the rest of mine, it says Chief Turf. So Chief Turf still decides to fire the cannon, but Nimona turns herself into that phoenix and then explodes herself, and it's actually really sad. Nimona turns into the phoenix force, everything goes boom, and then we cut forward, I guess, like a few days. Bal and Ambrosius have a little kissy-kissy. Ambrosius apologises about cutting off his boyfriend's arm. Sure. As you should, really.
As he should. Also, the explosion when it happens, like, looks, we find out that behind the wall,
looks lovely, looks like the
pretty
slay, time.
Actually, everything's, it's actually quite nice out there.
Basically, we see all of the citizens, they now are putting up posters saying, "We love you, Nimona." Bal goes back to his lair, puts up an "I love you, Nimona" poster that has been written, and then we hear, "Hey, boss," Nimona's voice, and then we smash cut to the credits. Booyah!
And then I pray for a sequel, and then I am on my knees begging for an entire cinematic universe. I want a full Netflix animated series. I want the merch. I want the toys. I want capitalism really popped off with this one.
I'm okay with it being just a very good movie. I don't think everything needs a sequel. Also, more 90-minute movies, please, in my life. Thanks. In a year where every Oscars movie was like 3 hours
agreed.
Long, that's obviously too much.
And truly, every time there is a 90-minute movie, though, we seem to record for 7 hours. So we've actually done quite well today, only slightly over time.
So, Rowan, what would you give this movie? So for those of you that are new here, we rate each of our movies using the six-barred rainbow flag. For those of you who don't know, the six-barred rainbow flag, each of the colors corresponds to a meaning. We give each of the movies a certain number of the bars and the corresponding colors with their meanings. There's red, which means life or sex, orange, which is healing, yellow, which is sun or sunlight, green, which is nature, blue, which is harmony, and purple, which is spirit. Rowan, how many bars of the rainbow flag and which ones will you give Nimona?
Nimona's getting six. I love this movie. And the more that I watch it, the more I'm like, pick up these little moments. There's like little asides that are funny. There's little like, which I love in cartoons, in comedy cartoons, where someone will do ADR of an extra in the background to say something funny.
Yeah.
And I love picking up on that. We had the same thing with Bottoms, actually, that we commented on stuff like that. I really enjoyed. The animation is stunning. It's the kind of thing that I just feel like I can just see a whole generation of like young queer kids having watched this and really having it resonate with them, even if they don't entirely know why in the moment. Like, it feels like one of those movies that in 5 years, 10 years time, people will talk about this as one of those movies where it's like, oh, you were obsessed with Nimona when you were a kid, right? Yeah, like then you think back years later and you're like, wow, I should have guessed. Like, it feels like such an exciting film, and I'm really excited to see more from Andy Stevenson as well. So yeah, it's getting all six for me. How about you?
I'm only gonna give it four.
and oh my god, I've been
betrayed. I'll tell you
today,
for why
listeners.
I'll tell you for why
I've been actually like stabbed through the heart.
Here. I'm actually Glorious Statue. It's me. I'm the Chief Turf. So
you hate non-binary despise. Children is what I'm hearing.
Just to be clear, not at all for tech trans and non-binary kids. But I'm only going to give it four because, okay, I adore these characters. I adore these themes. Like, I talked about how much, like, it resonated with me as a fucking older millennial fucking MB queer. Like, this was for me as much as it is for, like, the kids who are figuring themselves out. I adored this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the world needed more building out. There were holes in this and lack of depth of some of the secondary characters that I would have liked to have seen more of. And I think actually a movie was not necessarily the best way to convert this into this type of media. I think this may like the richness of these characters probably lent it, in my opinion, it lends it more to like a series than it does to a 90-minute movie, even though I just praised the fact that it was only 90 minutes. So I'm going to give it four. And I'm going to give it orange for healing, obviously. Yellow for sunlight because of that sun poking through the clouds when the ball is broken at the end.
Aww.
Nature, green, purple for spirit because it's full of spirit.
Aww.
So there you go.
It is. I'll allow it, I guess. It's normally me who's a stickler for stupid random plot holes in the lore of something, but I'm happy
well,
for you to
one,
take that.
Well, one of us has got to be strong in the face of, what am I saying? Now to close, Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. If you enjoy these episodes, then we ask that you consider supporting us on Patreon. As a patron, you can join our Queer Movie Club, where we do watch-alongs on our Discord each month, and there's a load of other perks for various amounts of money, and it helps keep this podcast going. We love doing it for you, and we think we provide a good service. So sign up and support us there. Thank you so much also to Jennifer and Toby for supporting us on Patreon as our rainbow parents. And make sure you follow and subscribe to the podcast on whatever podcatcher you use. I've been Jazza John. Who've you been?
I've actually been Rowan Ellis.
Oh my god, that's so fun for you. Thank you so much, my darlings. We'll see you soon.
Bye.